Welcome to episode 69 of Mean Old's World. Thank you all for joining me again this week, and thank you all for your lovely messages on social media last week. I mentioned that things became a bit too much for me because for the first time I'm working full-time and trying to balance out all my chores at home, and honestly last week I just felt like I was hit by a train. I was so exhausted. So I decided to take a small break, and you all showed me so much love and compassion, so thank you. But this week I'm back, and I was joined by Christine Armstrong. Just like a lot of my podcast guests, I met Christine during the pandemic and we connected online. And it's been such a pleasure to learn more about her work and learn about the real impact she's had on women. When Christine gave birth in 2009, things seemed okay and manageable. But it wasn't until she had her second child in 2011 when she realized that the reality of managing a career and being a mother was far from what she had expected. And in 2018, Christine published her book, The Mother of All Jobs, after extensively researching the impact on women's careers after giving birth. And her book had struck a chord with women across the world. And then, as they say, the rest is history. Now, if you're listening to this on iTunes, please do leave a review and subscribe. It would really help us reach out to more people. Now, I could go on and give a long introduction about Christine, but as always, without further ado, here's Christine Armstrong. Welcome to the show, Christine. It's so lovely to have you on after meeting you virtually almost a year ago. How are you?
I'm good. It's so lovely to be here. So nice to talk to you.
Yeah, every time we've met, it's just been, we'll catch up soon. And now we're finally doing that. So it's nice to get to do this. Christine, I wanted to start off by asking you your journey as a mother, because I think that with you, when I read about your work, I realized that actually Christine had that moment of realization that actually it's quite hard. whereas for me, I only had that realization because I saw other mothers speak about it. If not, I think I would have just carried on doing it because I guess just have to get on with it, right? Like the rest of the world has. What was that tipping point for you where you said, I actually need to speak up about this, being a mother and trying to manage my career at the same time?
I think for me, the tipping point was I found it really difficult. And I did what a lot of women that I interview in our research do, which is to blame myself, to look at me and my partner, like, what are we doing wrong? How are we not organized enough? Why don't we lean in? Why is it not working? It seems to work for everybody else. And remember that my kids are now 12 and 10 and 8. So I was sort of going through this 10, 12 years ago, and lean in was still really fashionable. It was kind of the book that was around. And so the message coming out was that, we've done this. This is not so bad. You just need to suck it up. And so because I couldn't cope, I started interviewing women for Management Today magazine about their experiences. And what I realized was this big gap between what they would say to me when it was recorded as an interview like this and then what they would say privately. So I would do these interviews and they would be like, well, you know, it pretty much works. And, you know, my husband's a rock and my organization's really supportive. Da, da, da. And then they would talk a lot and I would write it down and we would publish it. And then they would say, oh, do you want to have a drink or lunch or dinner, or whatever? I'll come to an event and I'd go and meet them. And they would say things like, well, of course, you know, there's the divorce. And I'd like look at them and they'd be like, oh, did I not tell you about the divorce? I mean, no, it's pretty significant. Or, you know, actually, there's been a, you know, real trouble at work with my boss and it's being investigated because they haven't been supportive at all. Or I'm going to leave my job because actually, I mean, one person said to me, do you know, if I said what I really thought to you, Christine, I'd never work in my industry again. And I just thought, there is a whole story here that is not women failing, mothers failing. There is a whole system that doesn't work. And because of the way that the media works, just the way we talk about it, we're not able to be honest about that.
And this was 10 years ago, Christine. So Did you feel completely alone when you were trying to vocalize how you were feeling at that time?
Completely alone. I was working in an organization that where there were no other working mothers at all. There was one senior working father, but he had a largely, you know, supportive wife who didn't, I mean, she did work, but, you know, was at home quite a lot and led the household. And then there was me. My husband, I have to say, is massively supportive and much more engaged as a parent than most of the women that I interview. And he was doing a huge amount, but still it was brutally, brutally difficult. And I just didn't see other people in my industry in the same space. But then when I would go out for this in the book, there's a scene where I go out for a friend of mine, she's a lawyer, and we basically drink a bottle of wine each and eat an entire baked camembert and like tottering home.
It's very detailed.
Yeah. It was just like one of those nights where we kind of met for one drink and then it was like, this doesn't work. And then I was just like, it doesn't work for her. It doesn't work for me. It doesn't work for these women that I interviewed. There is a much more complicated story to be told here.
I wanted to touch on what you just mentioned earlier, which was this whole idea of blaming, where you kept blaming yourself and not even thinking about actually could be things around me that are going wrong. How did you change that mindset to say, actually, I'm doing the best I can and I'm working with the best with what I have?
I think it was only by saying that nobody was able to make it work. And then you kind of go, aha. So if I've spoken to all of these apparently massively successful working parents, I spoke to mums and dads, and none of them is able really to tell me that this is working brilliantly for them unless they have made some big decision, which is to change their life very fundamentally to make it work, then it's not me. Then it has to be the system. And therefore, we have to look at the system. And, you know, the work that Pregnant and Screwed is doing, I think, is just absolutely amazing to kind of break this apart and say, you know, why are we not able to create a system that means that we can work and have successful home lives? And what's the problem? And one of my frustrations, for instance, is that business gets called out every year on the gender pay gap, right? And they kind of accept responsibility and they say, we've got a 20% pay gap, whatever. Business is not out there saying to government, do you know what? Where's your piece in this? Where's the affordable childcare? You can call us to account on the gender pay gap when you provide or enable affordable childcare, because then we would have a chance of delivering it. But it's like the whole system doesn't work together.
And that's one of the things that I realized, Christine, and you can probably see I'm just nodding my head so much because I'm just like, wow, he's saying everything I've been thinking of. And this last month, so my husband, Nishant, has just qualified as a GP. And now he's in between looking for jobs. So I've said, okay, I'll go to work. You can enjoy your time with Radhika. And the first week, we didn't say anything to each other because I was like, I'll just let him see what it's been like to be at home. And it was just one week in and I could just see it in his eyes. I was like, Nishant, are you okay? And he goes, this is hard. This is really hard. This is exhausting. And he said, on top of that, you were up with her all night as well. And you were taking her to the baby and you were doing everything. And he had that realization, but that only happened because he was put in that situation. And I don't think a lot of fathers get to do that because they just get on with, right, with their careers because it's what they have to do.
So this is the way that our system has been designed, is that men, you know, get maybe a week or 2 weeks paternity when the baby's really tiny, usually at a time when mothers and mothers-in-laws and extended family and friends and sisters and aunties and all sorts of people appear. And then the second those people go back, there is a woman left alone with a baby and the men are sent back to work. And that is the way. And then we have men in government, in big businesses going, I don't really see why this is a problem. Like, what's the issue here? Like, we just need to, I don't know, they just need to get a nanny because it's not been an issue. And I think the visceral understanding that your husband has is not an understanding that, for instance, Boris Johnson has. I don't think Keir Starmer has it. I don't think that most of the people, you know, the 90 out of 100 FTSE leaders of our biggest corporations have it. So therefore, it's not embedded in the system of decisions that we're making as a society.
Yeah. And I've been going back to work and I've seen lots of women who are in my position with one kid, two, three kids, and they either have two options in front of them, Christine, which is one, you just work sort of ad hoc. When you get a chance, you go into work, get your money and go home. Or you go into a training program and you move up the ladder, but you can only do that part-time. So something that would have taken my husband 2 years would probably take me 5 years because I physically can't do full time. So that's one of the setbacks. And then the other setback is obviously the pay, because if I do go into work, Radhika has to go into nursery. And I calculated if I did go into a training position where I could go up the ladder, I'd be coming home with £150 a month as a doctor.
Yeah. And you have a great job, right? So for anybody on a sort of average salary who just doesn't, I mean, it's just, you know, there's been some research that showed that on average, the cost of childcare per month in an area is about the same as the average woman's pay in that area. So we've made working economically you know, insane for people. It doesn't make any sense. Like, I'm not going to be with my kid. I'm not going to raise them exactly maybe as I want to or spend that time with them. And also I'm going to have no short-term economic benefit. You know, I've interviewed so many women who are at a loss after paying for it. And some of them decide to do that because they say, well, in 10 years, this will be worth it. And there is, you know, that's true. But it's a really hard, brutal decision working a full month and then coming home with 50 quid or 20 quid or 150 quid because you're like, why am I doing this? The system is not supporting me.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of women do it because they just see other people do it and they're like, well, this is all I have and this is what I'm going to work with. And it's really sad to see that because, you know, they say, well, my son is 8 months or my daughter's 8 months and I'm not with them. Right. And a part of me is crying for them because I've spent a good 2 years with Radhika now. Yeah. I've loved every moment of it. Obviously, I've had to sacrifice my career, but we're all just having these conversations all the time and there's just no answer. Is that can we ever find a balance? And the answer is no, not in this system.
Well, the answer is affordable childcare and sensible working hours, neither of which we are great with, right? And I think your point about training is well made. I just mentioned this because I know you're a medic, but my sister qualified as a dentist and she then did her surgery exams and she would have loved to have been a consultant, but she would have had to be doubly qualified in order to be a consultant. So her husband is a consultant and she is a staff grade or something. You know, she has to be one level, even though she has been doing oral surgery since she qualified, you know, 30 years ago. So it does limit women's career. It limits their ability to earn a good pension, to earn a good salary and to be successful. And that's partly to do with the timing of the training. But really, to your point, it's about the cost. It's about the cost of childcare.
Absolutely. And I also think, Christine, with especially, I mean, when you're looking at childcare and motherhood, we can't look at it through one lens. There's lots of different lenses we need to look through because I think cultural expectations play a role in this as well. So when I had my daughter, it was the first grandchild of the family, everyone was just like, get on with it. We've all had children. And like my grandma was like, I've had seven children, like you'll be okay. But I realized, Christine, I'm the first working mother in my whole family's history. Right. There's been no woman in my household, especially from my side, where they've had children and they've had to work. So I've got nobody to look back to and say, well, what do I do? I need help. And I think that's been the big, big issue. Now we have the internet, so it's a lot easier. But 10 years ago, I think you were probably one of the first people to speak up about this.
So I do think role models are really important, to go to your first point. So where I've interviewed women and say their mother has said, you know what, my mother raised four kids and worked in a factory and had, you know, dinner on the table, they're like, so I will always work. And that really does, it liberates them from the guilt and the sort of mental complexity. And my mother always worked part-time, certainly, you know, and certainly a secondary role, what we would call sort of one and a half kind of a makeup of a household. So she would work in school, but she didn't work. She'd often do mornings, whatever. But, you know, she did always work and she very much encouraged all of us to work. So I think the role model piece is really, really important. And I think, sorry, there was a second piece to what you asked, which I was going to answer, and now it's gone out of my head. The role model.
I said, and the second piece was, sorry, Christine, I need to be much better at this, asking two separate questions. the second part of it was, were you one of the first people to speak up about this 10 years ago? Because in my position currently, I'm okay because I have these role models. Yeah. But did you have that?
No, 10 years ago, the language was very much around supermums, women who'd made it, the world had changed. And I think that there was sort of a weird trajectory where the 70s and 80s were horrible for women to work in a lot of ways, in that there was a lot of sexism overtly in the workplace, far fewer role models, far more male-dominated workplaces. But we didn't have always on. And so people, when I interview them about working that period, say, yeah, there were loads of complexities, loads of shit things. But I went in, I did my job, and then I'd finish at 5 or 6, and then I was gone and I was with my kids. And so if I had childcare and I could afford it, I could sort of make it work. With the extending of working hours, with both parents working, with always on, where people are just on their devices, now people are like, you know, it's 8 o'clock at night, they're trailing around Waitrose trying to get some food with their kids, still on a conference call. And that's even worse, right? Or in the NHS, people are just working these extraordinarily long shifts. And then when they do finish, they're completely exhausted and overwhelmed. And I think that has, those working hours have made it more difficult. So I think we had to click out of this language. I remember seeing an interview with Karen Brady. And I just honestly, it made me just want to lie down on the tube floor carriage and cry. It was like in one of those free newspapers in London. It was like, well, I have the perfect work-life balance because my kids live in the country and I work 4 days a week in London and my kids are really well looked after. Da-da. Like, this was the perfect way. Like, everyone could have a house in the country. And I know that's not what she was saying, but I'm reading this just going, yeah, fine. It probably does work if you're Sheryl Sandberg and have 10 members of staff, if you're Karen Brady and have 2 houses and all your kids in private school and an army of people to help. But for anyone who is just trying to get to the end of the month and pay the mortgage and the gas bill, this doesn't work.
Yeah. No, that's really... And I listened to one of her, Karen Brady's interviews once, and she just said, when someone was asking why she's so confident and stuff, and she said, I don't see no as a no. I see it as an opportunity. And I was like, yeah, because you earn a lot of money and like, you're at that stage where you can have that confidence. That advice doesn't work for me. and this is the thing. I do think a lot of this stuff is quite toxic, actually, that, you know, people looking for advice in the wrong place can be the worst thing that can happen. And I've noticed that as a doctor as well, because 2 years ago, people were telling me, just go into your career, put your child in nursery. And if I'd listened to them, I think I would have been really miserable.
I think you have to look at who you're taking advice from. And what I learned from those Management Today pieces was that if somebody is named, if their organization is named, and if they feel the pressure to be a role model for other women, they cannot tell you the truth. And it's not because they're terrible people. It's because they want other women to do well. It's awful to feel like, you know, say you, I don't know, work at a bank and to say, right, I run this team, but honestly, it didn't work for me. I'm really worried about my kids. I'm worried about my marriage. I'm really stressed. I don't sleep very well. To be completely honest, I'm drinking too much. You can't say that when your name and your organization is on it. But those are the things that people really say if you talk to them. And so I think we have to break apart this kind of attachment to who says it. And bearing in mind that the women that I was interviewing for Management Today were very privileged women. They were really well paid women. And so that was why in the book I went kind of like, well, let's talk to everybody, because if they can't make it work and most of them have way, way above average budgets, then how is everyone else doing this? And they're not. They're struggling. Is trying.
What was it like for you generally in terms of when you had birth and that period where you were on maternity leave? Because I think one of my biggest qualms with the NHS is that they just don't prepare women enough, or they probably just give us information that it is important, but we need more. We definitely need more as women. I mean, I was never advised on sleep deprivation. I was never advised on how to sort of be content with what will happen if I don't do my job, or if I don't go to send the baby to nursery, to balance all of these things. And I felt very ill-equipped, actually. And I think that really contributed to a lot of my stress and anxiety in that postpartum period. And obviously, we're in a pandemic, that didn't help either. But what was it like for you, Christine?
It was very hard. I mean, well, it was very hard on one level. I think one of the things that is more difficult about this is if you think about having a baby in a village 100 years ago, you would have been surrounded by people who had babies. You would have grown up with cousins, nieces, nephews all over the place. And I think you would have had a much better lived experience. And most of us, we go into we go through our education, we go into training or university, whatever it is that we do. Then we go into the workplace and we may not have seen many small children. We live in our own house, in our own, often further away from our immediate family than we would have done historically. So all of us end up in these kind of houses looking one-on-one at a baby and staring at them going, what the hell do you and I do? Like, how do we be? How does this work? And I interviewed, it was a dentist, it wasn't my sister, it was a dentist in London. She said, she did a huge amount of work with the Bangladeshi community because that's where her practice was. And she said that they would come in and mums would come in dripping, you know, children, like, bring in 3 or 4 different children to have their teeth done. The children would be perfectly fine, play on the ground, no problem. Then they'd go, right, we're doing the shopping on the way home. They'd go. And then she said she'd have a woman come in with a professional job, running in, one kid, the kid's like, mom, 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 kid's stressed, mum's stressed, everybody's rushing, mum's bribing the kids, and like really stressful. And she was just like, listen, you know, there's people who are in wider communities that are well supported, that are doing better, and it's not necessarily the people who are living on their own disconnected. So I think there's something about connection that's really important. I was pretty fortunate from my own experience, just in that my husband took voluntary redundancy after 18 years of working for BT and various spin-offs. So actually both of us were mostly there for our first child. It got much harder when he set up a business and I was in a business, in a job that really didn't work for me. And we kind of collapsed probably after the second one, probably tipped us over. And then we kind of had to reconfigure everything about how we lived and the decisions that we made.
Yeah. And your priorities change as well when you have children. You start to look at it, well, what do I want, not just for my life in 5 years' time, but for my child or for my daughters as well. When you wrote that book, what was the response like from mothers in general? Did everyone sort of connect with you? Or
the first thing that happened was that the Eleanor Mills, who's amazing, who's the editor of the Sunday Times magazine, put it on the front cover of the magazine, and I wrote a 5,000 word piece. And I just got this message from somebody at the Sunday Times saying it was the most read piece that whole year in the magazine with the longest dwell time. And I got over 1,000 messages over the next 2 days from people saying, I just can't, you've finally said how my life is. Finally, somebody said it. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I got one from a man, of course, telling me that I was wrong, but the rest were all.
I was going to say, you must have had that, right?
I got one. You know, I was like, thank you. I'm so glad that you've conformed to exactly what we were expecting. It was a totally overwhelming. It's how I got to know Jolie at Pregnant Then Screwed, because she emailed me and said, okay, I've now been sent your article 7 times. You and I need to talk, which was lovely. And so it was just this like outpouring, and people read it and they call, you know, I still get messages all the time saying, I'm reading your book and I'm crying on the tube or I'm crying on the train because, you know, you just, this is how I feel. Other people read it and say, actually, it's a bit depressing. And that is part of the challenge that you're talking about. You know, if somebody's 8 months pregnant and I say, listen, let's talk about sleep deprivation. Let's talk about birth tears. Let's talk about this impact this may have on your relationship with your partner. It's not necessarily a really cheery talk. And it's a kind of a, how much of that do we want to talk about? And it's kind of an individual appetite. How much of that do people want to hear?
Yeah, because it does kind of burst the fairy tale bubble, doesn't it? Of what motherhood should be like. And I was in that little bubble as well. I was like, I'm going to raise my daughter. We're going to have the best time ever. And then that none of that happened. And I think that's a lot of all about expectations. And I feel like over the last 2 years, I've just spent so much time managing and thinking about my expectations. That's all I've been doing. You think you want to be 100%, but sometimes you can't. And it's been really, really difficult to accept that. But I think that's the beauty of it, Christine. You get to know yourself as an individual as well through that time.
You do. And there's two different ways that I observe people doing it. And one is what it sounds like you've done, which is to go, right, this is the transition. I'm a mother and I'm going to think about how I organize my life. Other people that I interview, it's sometimes they, with their first child particularly, they kind of go, I'm just going to carry on with the way that things were. I'm just going to keep working. I'll get childcare if I can afford it, and I'll just keep going. And it's often with the second child that they flip, which is kind of what happened to us. I think with my first, I kind of like tanked on through it. And the second one, I was like, okay, now we have to reset everything. It's like at some point, I think it kind of fundamentally changes everyone. It's just the question of when that transition happens. And then afterwards, you kind of adjust and you reset. And I think things kind of start to rebuild.
Yeah. Christine, I know that after you wrote that book, and after you had your kids, you've been going into your own sort of business where you've been trying to give workshops and trying to educate people more about this kind of stuff that we've been talking about today. What is the main transition you've seen in the last 10 years? I know that a lot has happened, especially the internet has played a big role in it. But have you seen people become more accepting to the idea that actually motherhood is quite hard? And have you seen more men getting involved in the conversation?
Yeah, so the pandemic's helped men to understand it. And I'll give you a really good example, actually. So I was doing some workshops with an organization that we work with quite a lot. And just to say, a lot of my work isn't on working and parenting anymore, but some of it still is. And there was a dad whose wife was a nurse. And during the pandemic, he was at home, of course, with 2 kids while she was obviously at the hospital. And he was crying on a Zoom call with about 60 of his colleagues because he was so broken and exhausted. And like, I'm trying to do a job. I'm like, yeah, you and every single other parent in the country is trying to do this. And he was like, but I'm just on my own. I was like, yeah. And so are loads and loads of other people. It's not, I don't want to sound unsympathetic, but it was just, it suddenly hit some people who'd been really well protected from some of the realities of it. So I think that that was brilliant. I don't know how long that memory stays. I think the big change that we see is the rise in paternity leave. And we know that that's really important for the reasons you just discussed with your husband. But also, and I'd love you to look into this as a medic, but I saw some research from America that men's testosterone levels change after they have kids. They literally drop and they become more empathetic and more sort of responsive to children. But if they don't spend time with those babies and children, it goes back to where it was before. But if they spend time with those children, it permanently mellows them. It permanently makes them more cooperative collaborative in terms of the family unit and more engaged. So I think that's why paternity leave may be even more important on a sort of biochemical level than it maybe even is on a practical level. And I think that's one of the really, that I think that's becoming much more mainstream. We're seeing some great companies introduce equal allowances, which is fabulous. And I think that's something we should really be pushing for.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that especially I've had in the NHS is that there's just so much paperwork involved in just trying to get something so simple. And even my maternity leave and Nishant's paternity as well, there was just so much red tape to go through. I just wish that they would make it easier. And a simple example was that when I was pregnant and I was going through my pregnancy sickness and I needed some help from occupational health, they said they'll get back to me in 2 months. I was like, I might literally be on a drip by that time. You know, I can't. And I think that we need to change this, that there has to be some sense of urgency, I think, when it comes to pregnant women who ask for help.
I think the other thing which I would love to see is the continuity of care in pregnancy. And I think that's something that's being more talked about. But certainly when I had my kids, it was like a revolving door into UCLA. Every time you went in, you saw a different midwife and a different doctor every single time. I literally never, for my first pregnancy, saw the same midwife twice. And so you get no continuity of care. So when you do have a problem like extreme sickness or any sort of complication, you're re-explaining it every single time and you don't feel that you are held by anybody in the system. And I think that we're treating women like cars in a car factory. You know, we'll put the steering wheel here and we'll paint them over there, rather than actually something that's a precious, it's the most important thing they're ever going to do. This is an incredibly exciting, important, precious moment. And we should be, you know, treasuring that, making the best of it, supporting them through that, not kicking them through a system.
Sure. It has to be a more holistic approach to all of this. I completely agree. Christine, I know you have to go off now because you're in a rush, but thank you so much for your time.
I've got sports day. I'm expecting
as important.
I'm so sorry.
But Christine, just before you go, I just want you to say, if you had to give one piece of advice to any mother right now who's just had a baby or is about to have a baby, what would you say to them?
Networks. Work on your hyper-local networks. I mean, the people who live next door, at the end of the road, anywhere that you can get to on a micro scooter in the pouring rain, because those people in your immediate locality who are going through it at a similar life stage, who get it, who can make you laugh, make you a cup of tea, pick your kids up when you just can't cope anymore or your train's late, those are the people that are going to keep you sane for the next 10, 15, maybe 20 years. So invest time now in making those networks and it will change your life.
And also read your book. That will also help you. Thank you so much for your time, Christine.
Thank you so much. Take care. Bye-bye.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in again this week. And of course, a huge thank you to Christine for joining me as well. And this podcast is only possible thanks to all my guests who join me every week and find time in their busy schedules to share the personal journeys of learning and growth. You can find all of Christine's work on her website, christinearmstrong.com, and I've left a link to all the socials in the episode description below. You can also follow me on social media and stay up to date with all podcast episodes. All my social media handles are at Dr. Meenal Viz. Thank you again for joining me. I hope you have a lovely week ahead, and I'll see you all next week.